Love that introduction. The music that blares, it happens to be the instrumental that precedes one of my very favorite songs. It is called This Land Is Mine. It is the Exodus song. The tune, the melody, the instrumental is uplifting. It uses a lot of trumpets, which is really appropriate, and that Yahweh announces his news to the world. He draws attention to his plan, his offer, by a shofar, which is a ram's horn trumpet. And it speaks of the land, the promised land. This would be Yisrael. And it might seem presumptuous to say, well, why would you be comfortable by calling this land mine when in fact it is Yahweh's land? But for his chosen people, he gave his land to them. And since we can become his chosen people, can become members of his family in one of two ways, either being naturally born into the family, being descendants of Abraham, of Yitzhak and Jacob, or we can choose to be adopted into the covenant. And so it makes the promised land, which is a metaphor, in addition to being a real place, for living with God in his home, for camping out with him in his universe. And so that's what the music that plays during the breaks and introducing this show represents. Shattering Myths itself is designed to represent what is the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those who have finally come to know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are rotten, that they are corrupt, that they are actually counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interests, to understand why they are doing so, because exposing and condemning treacherous schemes isn't hateful, even when they're patriotic and religious. It's the most enlightened and caring thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah. It means teaching, not law. And it's liberating, it's enriching, it's empowering. Covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and for your family. Anytime during the next 3 hours, if you would like to engage in this program, ask a question, make a comment, challenge the host, you're welcome to do so. I am Yada. Our toll-free number is 877-300-7645. The commercial played again. It is on SRN, Salem Radio Network, which is a Christian radio network. It is from the Billy Graham organization. It asks the ignorant, the faithful, believers, those who have been beguiled, those who haven't a clue who God really is or what he's offering, to celebrate a purely pagan Babylonian holiday in a big way, Easter. If you are unaware, Easter is Babylonian, the very place that God asks his children to walk away from before they can engage in a relationship with him. If you are still mired in Babylon, which is what Easter represents, it's the most important day on the sun god religious holiday schemes of ancient Babylon. If you're still celebrating it, then there is a 0% possibility that you could be engaged in a relationship with God, which means you cannot be saved. Celebrating Easter precludes your salvation. That's something. First requirement of the covenant is to walk away from Babylon. Now, the Billy Graham organization knows that there is no spiritual basis. There is no scriptural basis for Easter. They know it. They're not stupid. They went to school. They're promoting a lie because it enriches them. Don't follow their lead. In this commercial, I thought I heard it yesterday, but definitely heard it today. It's the cross of Billy Graham. It sounds a lot like Paul. He had his own cross. The cross of Billy Graham. Well, Billy Graham may have a cross. God doesn't have one. It is a pagan symbol, born and bred in Babylon, just as Easter was conceived there. Don't fall for it. Walk away from graven images. A cross is a pagan graven image. The commercial asks us to, it says that by sharing the cross of Billy Graham, by celebrating Easter in this big way, that you and others can come to know Jesus. No person or God by that name ever existed. It is impossible to know Jesus. If you don't know his name, you are clueless as to who he was. And his name, most assuredly, was not Jesus. In a brief news bite promoted by SRN was the notion that Christians have a militia in the Central African Republic. They don't. The name of the Christian means of responding to Islamic aggression is called anti-machete. Anti-machete says that they have been hacked to death and brutalized by Muslims. What happened in the Central African Republic is that some very misguided individuals, ignorant of Islam, trusted Muslims and empowered them. They then immediately began to act like Muslims. And they imposed Sharia law and they encouraged Muslim militias to burn churches, to murder Christians, burning them alive in their homes, and to savage the non-Islamic population, which they did. Christians, which are the majority of the population in the Central African Republic, weren't going to stand by idly and watch their women and children massacred by the Muslims. And so they formed groups called anti-machete, anti-Islamic assaults. The day that we begin to present a defensive response to religious and violent aggression as the lead, as opposed to in the proper order of things, is when we lose all perspective. It's like saying that there is a Arab-Israeli conflict and that that conflict needs to be resolved so that there can be peace. Well, Israel has always been the victim. Muslims have always been the aggressor. They have been the aggressor since the first day that Islam was conceived. They have continued to be the aggressor for all 1,400 years that Islam has existed. Israel has only sought to defend itself. Defending oneself from violent aggression is not akin to being an aggressor. And it is disgusting. It is reprehensible. It is completely unjustified and inappropriate to present people who are defending themselves as if they were in the same place, similarly motivated, similarly irresponsible as those who are perpetrating these crimes in the first place. And that really is part of our problem today. In the news media, particularly when you have a religious news source, they have no perspective. They just clearly do not understand. And understanding is paramount. We live in a very dangerous time. Things are disintegrating all around us. Understanding is important. It's very important for all of us to observe what's happening, to thoughtfully consider it, and to render a rational, moral, logical verdict so that we can appropriately respond not only disassociating ourselves from those who are deliberately deceiving and those who are purposefully harming those they have sworn to serve, but also so that we can embrace the only individual in this universe that is completely trustworthy, Yahweh. Turning to another story, and it reveals the hypocrisy of government. NATO, this is a CNN article, it reads, NATO sees no sign that Russia is pulling back its forces from the border with Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said today, despite Moscow's claim of a partial pullback. You know, during the Cold War, there was the Warsaw Pact and then there was NATO. And the USSR was the principal architect of the Warsaw Pact, while America was the principal architect of NATO. And these were seen as opposing forces. Yeah, very similar to the kinds of treaties that brought the world into World War I following a meaningless event. The United States and Europe are still fighting that war. They want the Ukraine to become part of NATO. It's obvious. Russia here is actually the victim. The victim of Obama still living in that era. You know, he continues to besmirch Putin, saying that he needs to grow beyond this, that he's still living in the Cold War era when the rest of the world has moved on. No. This is NATO reporting. This isn't an independent observer. It's NATO. It's NATO has an interest because NATO wants to claim the Ukraine, and NATO wants to claim the Ukraine because it can show that it is winning a war which most of the world gave up on decades ago. The Ukraine represents a prize to be claimed. Not much of a prize, mind you, but nonetheless, that is the view. Now, in this particular case, you look at America. It has killed thousands of people with its drones in foreign countries, invading their airspace, killing civilians, no due process. Thousands of them. It has sent its warships and warplanes and troops across the world, to the other side of the world, where they have invaded countries. Millions have died. We'll compare that to the Ukraine in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering This. Before we continue our report on the differences and the hypocrisy associated with American malfeasance around the world and what Russia is doing in Russia, we have Daniel, who has called in. He is a first-time caller to the Shattering Mist program. I understand you live in the fine city, the archway city of St. Louis. Hello, Daniel. Welcome.
That is correct. Yes. Aloha, Yana. How are you?
Thank you. The aloha is a reference to the fact that a couple of weeks ago, my family and I had a vacation in Hawaii.
And I wanted to also say Lashana Tov, Happy New Year. It's the first of Aviv.
Yes, it is.
So.
yes, it is. Yes, Yahweh's year starts with the renewing of the moon's light, Kadash, closest to the time that the first grain crop, which is barley, buds, so you'll see the kernel of the grain, but that the grain is still green, growing and receptive, not yet ripe or hardened, in the plant. And that occurs typically in the new moon, closest to the spring equinox. From all reasonable observations, today is the beginning of the new year, and so on the 14th day, as the sun goes down on the 13th, because Yahweh's days start at sundown, we will commence our celebration of Pesach, and then the following day, Matzah and Bukurim. So, indeed, happy new year.
I'm looking very forward to it. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm looking very forward to it. I always wondered when I was a kid, why does the new year begin in the middle of winter? You know, it didn't make much sense to me. And then, as with all things that I learned from Yah's words, he had it right, and he always does, of course. But
yeah, in fact, let's talk about that. Yeah, let's talk about that just a moment, Daniel. The new year that is celebrated in the West, it's not celebrated in Islam because there is Muhammad was a nincompoop, and he thought that the that intercalendar month that has to be added to enable the moon phase, which is 29.5 days, to serve as a method of reckoning time, you have to add a month every 2 to 3 years. And God gave a formula for doing that. But Muhammad didn't understand it, so he eliminated it. So the Islamic year just meanders all around the solar year without any reason. But for the rest of the world, they ignorant of Yahweh. In fact, most people disgusted by Yahweh hate him. Most Christians don't know this. They actually hate God. They're opposed to most everything he had to say. So they have embraced the Roman New Year. The Romans observed, celebrated, honored, worshipped a god named Janus. And Janus was the doorkeeper, and therefore the beginning of things. And they established their new year, the beginning of things, with the winter solstice, because that was the time, was a huge celebration for them too, was the time of the year where the days became longer and the nights shorter. And so it is the festival that Christians celebrate now as Christmas. And shortly thereafter, they began their new year, and they called it Janus, which is where we get January. Now, from Yahweh's perspective, Dan, you probably know this, the new year was chosen for a specific reason, and that is that he constantly equates saved souls to grain, where the chaff is blown away and becomes useless and ceases to exist, and the pure kernel of the grain is something that is treasured. And what God is saying of this kernel is that, you know, not only is barley turned into bread, and that's why unyeasted bread removes the fungus of yeast from the bread, therefore the fungus of sin from our souls. God is saying that if we celebrate his invitations to meet with him, particularly Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, while we're still growing and receptive, then that's the best opportunity for us to accept what God has to offer and form a relationship with him. But if we wait until the time that we are hardened and no longer receptive, or we try to do it too soon before we're prepared, then it serves no purpose. So God specifically chose the time called Abib, when the young barley ears were green and growing and still receptive, to invite us to attend the three most important days on the annual calendar. I've talked right through this shortened segment, Daniel, but I hope you can stay with us, and we'll pick up where we left off as we begin the next segment after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shatteringness. We're considering insights being provided by Daniel. Daniel has called from St. Louis, and we've talked thus far about man's new year and God's new year and how they differ and what each is based upon. I'm rather fond of God's basis. It seems to be a lot more sensible to me, Daniel. As a matter of fact, I was just writing in a chapter I'm writing that if you were to synthesize the primary difference between those who engage in the covenant with Yahweh and those who are saved and those who are not and those who are estranged from him, I think that the single most important distinction is receptiveness. Whether or not someone is receptive to what God has to say, and whether they're willing to accept God's testimony, even when it is in conflict with their religious or political beliefs. And so, starting his year and beginning his invitations to meet with him during Abib, which is the time that the kernel in the barley is is growing, green, receptive, is fairly profound.
That's amazing. I guess it goes to the same thing. I always had wondered why September, October, November, December,
mm-hmm.
you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, and yet they're like 9, 8, or I'm sorry.
Right, yeah.
Whatever.
Right. it's 9, 10, 11. Yeah, you're having months that are out of sequence, and of course they're out of sequence, so that the Western calendar could embrace the concept that Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar were gods. And so in the Roman religious calendar, there were months added, July and August, for Julius and Augustus Caesar, so that they could be worshipped like Janus as a god. And that pushed September, you know, and October and November out of the sequence as to when they should, when the number would actually be appropriate.
It's fascinating. I guess this kind of leads into the next question, I guess comment on Kirk's question from yesterday.
Yes.
That you were talking about, you know, the kingdoms and the kings of this earth hoarding the wealth and why do they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me, personally, and I might be wrong, but I think it's because of their, you know, the wickedness of their hearts and their evil desires and their devotion to the enemy, who, I don't know if this is true, but is apparently the god of, little g, god of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of the story of Yahusha in Bamidbar, in the wilderness, where he's mm-hmm. tempted by the enemy, and
right.
he says, you know, bow down to me, and I can give you all the kingdoms of this earth. So,
right.
you know, if he's actually the one that had, you know, we know that Yah was the almighty and ultimate control,
right.
but,
right.
you know, he may have some sway on this little dirt ball that we call it here.
Yeah, you know, we got to be careful with the word control there. I was with you all the way
okay.
up to that point.
Yeah,
your point is extremely important. What the testimony says that is recorded there is, and it's also presented in Job, so it's in the Hebrew mm-hmm. testimony as well, that that Hasatan, the adversary, is actually the prince and the power of this world, that he is attempting to control this world, which is why Yahweh calls him Lord.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Lord attempts to control.
Yeah.
And so a Lord owns. And so the prince of this world isn't Yahusha. It isn't God. It's Hasatan, because God isn't mm-hmm. controlling. God created the universe, conceived life, told us who he is, introduced himself to us, offered a means for us to engage in a relationship with him, but he is not micromanaging things here on earth. He has no interest in control because he established his covenant based on free will.
I agree. You're right. I agree with you.
Yeah. And it's a small distinction. Now, on the big side of things, the point that you made is that when you really get down to what drives people to covet power, influence, wealth, prestige, these kinds of things, you look at the warlords who manage their personal estate of Saudi Arabia, for example. You know, they're worth tens of billions of dollars, and you say, so what? And they have harems, and they have these magnificent castles all over the place. You know, What drives them? Why do they care? I mean, why not spend the rest of their time benefiting the world? You know, why continue to amass wealth and protect that wealth? King Abdullah is about ready to die. He's he was seen limping and around, barely able to stand when Obama gave him an audience in Saudi Arabia. Well, Obama actually went to him, and he has an oxygen breathing tube in his nose. He's soon going to die, and he's soon going to find out that Allah isn't God. This serves him right. What I have found is that, and I guess I found this initially studying Muhammad. Muhammad perpetrated his deception of Islam, submission to him, for sex, power, and money. And the Quran makes it apparent that that was the reason. The Quraysh offered him sex, power, and money if he would stop warring against them and their gods and just simply accept their gods. And so he said, yeah. He named the three dominant gods of the Kaaba and said, yeah, I'll accept them, I'll advance them, I'll promote them. He accepted the deal for sex, power, and money. That's the satanic verses. And so it is, in everyone's case, it isn't always sex, power, and money, but it's one or more of those things that drives people to covet more than they rightfully should have.
And the control, they basically want the same thing the enemy wants, you know, on a smaller scale, I guess. Or,
right, yeah, control. It's true that that almost every human institution is somehow, in some way, influenced by the spirit of the Lord, the spirit that wishes to control, the adversary, Satan.
Yep, that's a shame, but it is the way it is. But soon King Messiah will be reigning.
We are soon in a position where, in fact, it's 2033, which is a meaningless year on Yah's schedule, but it's year 6000 Yah. And on Yom Kippurim, Yah is going to return. He's going to return undialed down, so it's not going to be Yahusha, but instead Yahweh. It's not a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, if you will. He's going to return on Yom Kippurim. He's not in a good mood. Most of those who have survived the tribulation will be annihilated upon his return. Almost everything that man has built and has established on Earth is going to be instantly destroyed. And he's going to return the entire conditions of Earth back to what was experienced in the Garden of Eden. And we're going to have the opportunity to live with him on this planet for the last 1,000 years of its existence, as if we were camping out with him in Eden. So that's kind of the future of things. And during that time, the principal difference between the world as we know it now and the world as it will be then is that first, everyone will know Yahweh, and there will be absolutely no religion, politics, militancy, no economic schemes. All of man's institutions will be gone.
I wish we could hurry it along, but I understand he's got the timing already designed.
I think that's part of his original calculation, by the way. I think when he actually created the universe, he put into the calculation that once man was out of the garden, that there would be 6,000 years until he could return, and then 1,000 years of celebration, so that the 6+1 plan would be intact. And also, even going back from his perspective at creation, we're still in the sixth day from the perspective of the Creator at creation, based upon what we know about relativity.
It's amazing how it all lines up when you care to to look into it.
It was a pretty amazing design and calculation.
And I guess the reason that I use the word control with our Father is because, you know, I guess I don't know what word to use, but ultimately, and you know this from your experience as well, that, you know, Daniel was saved from the lion's den, the three Hebrews from the furnace, and so ultimately when it comes down to it, you know, the power is his, I guess I should say. I don't know, you know, to say.
It is his universe, he has made promises, and he will honor those promises. No one can effectively combat him. People can do things which anger him and which frustrate him, but no one can is going to prevail by being an opponent. It is his universe. He is going to do exactly as he's promised. But in the meantime, he's going to allow humankind to be as rotten, as corrupt as they wish to be. In fact, I was writing in this one chapter, I was talking about, you know, there is a way in this world to enjoy the presence of Yahweh, to feel his presence, to know his will, to be part of what he's doing, and that is to actively observe his Torah, to closely examine and carefully consider his guidance and instructions. And when you're doing so, mm-hmm. you come to know him, you engage in a relationship with him, you're enlightened by him, you're uplifted by him, you have a dialogue with him. That's how you can engage with him, and that's how he engages with his children. He is not, however, interested in the minutiae of this world. He is not involved in international politics. He's not involved in a football game. He's not involved in a beauty pageant. He has nothing to do with the lottery.
And his ruach is a very tangible thing.
Yes, yeah. Particularly when you're studying, if you're immersed in his testimony, his ruach spirit becomes an essential aspect of your nature. It literally empowers us to know and understand. But she does not, and his ruach is feminine, she does act independently. And if someone were to say to God, listen, I just want you to introduce yourself to me, tell me who you are and what I need to know, she's not going to pay any attention. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. If you don't care enough about God to read what he has said, to care about what he has done, then he's not going to listen to you. We'll be back after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shadow and Mist. We're having a conversation with Daniel. The floor is yours, Daniel. I'm enjoying chatting with you as we kind of walk through perceptions that are important for people to understand.
And I hope I'm not going to take up all the time. I know you want to get back to the news, but I guess we left off about talking about the Yazruah. My parents are devout Christians. They attend Calvary Chapel Church, and they're just in love with their pastor, actually I'm going to be meeting with in 2 days. I'm going to get to sit down with the three of them, and that's amazing.
Yeah.
I guess leading into that.
Good luck with that. You know what the likelihood of success is with that is it isn't close to zero. It is zero.
Right. I know that.
But it gets right back to what we began with, which is receptiveness. The pastor makes a living misleading people on behalf of his religion. That pastor will discount even a statement from Yahweh himself. They will discount it. They will disregard it. They will attack you for sharing it. Even when the testimony that you're being brought to bear against their religion comes directly from the God that they claim inspired their Bible, even when you quote him, they will disregard him. They will be disgusted by his testimony, and they will be disgusted by you. And I'm not just saying that that's the likely outcome. I want our listeners to know that if you approach a religious person with God's testimony, debunking their religion, they become extraordinarily hostile. They hate God's testimony. They actually hate the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And they become vicious. And that's what Yosha experienced. That's what you're going to experience. Now, before we move on, Daniel, my guess is that you're not quite as smart as Yahusha.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, and you probably don't know Yahweh quite as well as Yahusha.
Definitely not.
No, and you're probably not as good a debater as Yahusha.
Definitely not. Actually, so that's one of my weak points.
Okay. Well, I'm stating the obvious. He is a diminished manifestation of God. Now, in each of his debates with religious individuals, did he ever go out to them and say, now I want to begin a debate? Or was in 100% of the cases, did they approach him and try to attack him? And was he simply responding to them?
You got a good point there. He was responding to them.
Right. Never sought them out. Never once sought them out. Because he knows what we're talking about now, that you can't save them.
Yeah.
Now, the second is, then when he was responding to them, is there any indication anywhere that any of the religious people who came to accost him, that they were persuaded by his argument?
No. Not that I'm aware of.
Not once. Not once.
Not once.
Now, since he's probably better equipped than you and I, what do you think our chances are?
Slim to none. I guess the reason that I want to do it, because every time I get to discussing this with my parents who claim to really believe, you know, in the B-I-B-L-E, and they really claim to love their their caricature of who God is.
Of course, yeah, of course.
Well, when we get to, when I get to trying to share just bits and pieces of the information with them, they go on an ultimate attack on me, you know, and then it's just like, I'm going to hell, and I'm basically yelling and argument, and makes my girlfriend very uncomfortable when she's around when it happens, but... I guess the reason that I want to sit down with them is because my mom has actually one time, and I don't know if it's only one time, but I know of one time where I said the true name of the Father and the Son, and she said, whoa, don't do that again. She felt the Ruach and was scared by it, actually, which is, which is very not good. But I want, she's kind of under my dad's hand, and he's under the pastor's hand. The reason that I want to do it is maybe there's an inkling of open-mindedness still there, or receptiveness still there for my mother. That's kind of the whole reason I'm trying to do this.
Okay. Well, let me give you something.
I understand that I'm, I mean, it's a zero. It's a 1% chance.
You are not going to reach her by presenting this in front of your father's pastor. I made an attempt to reach Jerry Falwell, whom Jerry Falwell, for those that don't know, is probably the most famous Protestant preacher in America, maybe in American history. The only person that could rival Jerry Falwell would be Billy Graham, although Billy Graham never had his own church. In my meeting with him, and I was very early on and when I've come to know how different Christianity was from religion, he ended up agreeing with everything I had to say and then dismissed it.